This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. A couple of times while a student at the University of Illinois, Steve Goodman, on his way back to Urbana from a weekend at home in the suburbs, decided to skip the stop in Champaign and ride all the way to the Big Easy. Those trips aboard the city of New Orleans would prove to be the inspiration for the song.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central Monday morning rail. There are 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks of mail. They're all out on the southbound Odyssey, and the train pulls out of Kankakee, rolls past the houses, farms and fields, passing towns that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of rusted automobiles. Singing good morning America, how are you? Saying don't you know me, I'm your native son. Yes, I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans, and I'll be gone 500 miles when day is done.
Steve Goodman, City of New Orleans. Our guest this afternoon is Clay Eales. He's the author of a new biography of Goodman, the title Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. The book includes a preface written by Studs Terkel, a foreword by Arlo Guthrie, and a CD tribute to Steve Goodman. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. We look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Clay Eales, our guest, is an author and editor. He lives in Seattle. He's been a reporter and photographer and has taught journalism. His new book, Steve Goodman, Facing the Music, is published by ECW Press. And you'll find Clay on the website www.clayeales.com, and that's CLAYEALS.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Clay, welcome to the program. How are you?
Oh, doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, those trips Steve Goodman made back and forth from Champaign to Chicago on the city of New Orleans proved to be the inspiration for that wonderful song. When and how did it begin to take shape?
Well, the song, you know, when he rode down to New Orleans and back, it was not too long afterward that he met up with a high school friend from suburban Chicago named Howard Primer. And with him, during high school, they had sneaked off to the Southside Blues Clubs. But on this particular night, they went to an Old Town Club, and they started sketching out the chorus of City of New Orleans on a napkin. You know, Goodman had the phrase in his mind, Good Morning America, and they were crafting the song, and, you know, the native son line came out, the native, you know, don't you know me, I'm your native son. And that was back in 1966, 67, right in the school year when Steve, at the end of that school year, dropped out to go to Greenwich Village to soak up some of the folk music scene there and get some more down-to-earth education about how to apply his craft. And so the song sort of, was brewing in his mind for several years. It really came together about 4 years later, soon after he was married, and he and his wife were traveling on the train again back down to Mattoon to visit his wife's grandmother, to whom Steve was to be introduced, and his wife fell asleep on the train, and Steve took out his sketchbook and started writing down the things he saw outside the window, and that became the story that he told about the song. He didn't often reference the 4 years earlier college time, because I don't think it was quite as romantic a notion. He kind of said that the muse visited him and it all happened in less than an hour on the train with his wife. And the funny thing is, he didn't actually finish the song on the train. He thought he had, but he came back to Chicago and was so excited about it, he played the song for a musician at the Earl of Old Town Club there, a musician named Richard Wedler, and Wedler was impressed by it, but not nearly as much as Goodman was, and he said, you know, that's a good train song, but a lot of people have written train songs. Gordon Lightfoot's written a train song. Why don't you do a Steinbeck and tell what happens on the train itself? And that's what prompted Goodman to write the second verse with all of the vivid images that we remember from the song, you know, the rocking mothers with the babes asleep and the paper bag that holds the bottle. And so that really became the final touch on the song, and he had it in the spring of 1970.
Mm. And how was it that Arlo Guthrie first heard that song?
Well, then you got to fast forward about, three-fourths of a year later. Steve and his wife went to a performance by Arlo at the Quiet Nightclub in Chicago. And that night, the club owner, who knew Goodman well, Richard Harding, kind of unceremoniously put Goodman and Arlo together in the back room and was yelling at Goodman to say, play him the train song, play him the train song. And Arlo makes a big deal about this in his concerts where he says, you know, songs? I hate songs. I don't want to hear songs. But he finally relented, he says, by saying, okay, if you buy me a beer, as long as that beer lasts, you can do anything that you want. Mm. And Goodman said, Arlo, all I want to do is play you one song. And then, you know, the punchline of Arlo's story is, well, that was one of the finer beers of my life.
What led Steve Goodman to his love of music and entertaining?
Oh, he was, you know, one of these people who was just born energetic. And you can trace his musical roots back to when he was a little kid. And in early grade school, he grew up in Albany Park in Chicago, a heavily Jewish neighborhood at that time. And he was the boy temple soprano star of his temple. I mean, he would sing. You got to go back to, this is the late 1950s, and this is the baby boom growing up. And there were bar mitzvahs, sometimes two or three every weekend, and he would be the one that you would come to see and hear sing these very traditional Hebrew songs. He would be this tiny guy up in the choir loft. They'd have to lower the microphone for him, and 300 to 400 people would listen to him every weekend as the soloist. And so he was no stranger to performing for major audiences, even as a boy. Mm. He didn't really gravitate to guitar, although he listened to the radio like a sponge. He spun the dial and listened to all styles of music, but he didn't really learn to play guitar until his high school years. And briefly at Roosevelt High School, he got some training from a friend, and then where he really started to take off on guitar was when his parents moved the family to suburban Chicago, to Niles, Morton Grove area, and he went to Maine East High School and learned from friends there as well.
Yeah. While he was in school, he had a job working as an usher at the Golf Mill Theater in the shopping center by the same name in Niles. I've been there a couple times.
Uh-huh.
And you tell the story in the book. He was an entertainer. Even then, I mean, you have him in his little usher outfit, his little red jacket. I'm picturing a bow tie, maybe. And what he would do is he would entertain the people in line, and he'd say, you know, things like, "Seating available in the first five rows only. Don't worry, it's a great movie, very funny. Don't worry about sitting up close. You'll have a great time. Come right in."
Well, this, as so many stories in the book came from, is from somebody who was a classmate of his and worked there with him. The book has so many voices in that respect. I'm so fortunate to have been able to contact so many people. And you can just see Steve doing that. And you have to picture, this is back in the mid-60s. before they had even heard of the word multiplex. And this is one giant theater, and other than late night old movies on TV, the way to go see a movie was at a great big theater, and this one was recently built out there, and so people would come, and they'd fill up the theater, and they'd stand in line for 2 hours to get to the next film, and you had to have somebody who could pacify them, who could make them feel like it was worth the wait, and that became Steve's role. He was a natural performer in that sense, just as you say.
Yeah, I have the companion CD ready to go here, Clay, with a cut that it contains clips from an interview that Steve Goodman did back in April of 1975. And I'd like to play that here because I want to hear Steve Goodman's voice again. And I want to hear him talk about his very humble, down-to-earth approach to being an entertainer. You want to set this up any further?
Well, sure. This guy was he was generous to a fault as a musician and a tough guy to interview because it was hard to get him to talk about himself. He would talk about other people, but when you finally drilled down to Steve talking about himself, he would make much less of himself than what so many other people thought of him. I mean, one example is that he would never say he wrote a song. He would say, "I made it up." You know, the self-deprecating quality was so endearing, and this comes across in these clips, which are from WXRT in Chicago. I'm so grateful that they let me include that on the accompanying CD.
Yeah, and the interviewer was a fellow by the name of John Platt.
Yes, and John is now a DJ and development manager in New York City at WFUV at Fordham.
Okay, well, let's go back to April of 1975.
You know, there's a lot of people not eating these days real good. So it's, you know, I don't think it behooves me to sit around and tell you how hard it is to travel around on airplanes and not work for a living. It's great.
Do you have any sense of guilt or anything about being a musician that way?
Oh, no sense of guilt. Shoot, I did this for enough years without getting paid for it that it's okay. You know, I mean, it all evens out, but I'm not about to sit here and tell somebody over the radio who's out of work, you know, how hard it was to play a concert and have everybody tell you how much they liked you and all that nonsense that happens to you when you do this. Ever since Arlo Cut City in New Orleans, it's been all right.
Yeah. That was a big difference for you.
No question about it. The day that thing went on the air, you could just feel the fog lifting. Luckiest thing that ever happened to me.
How did you feel about the way he interpreted the song?
I'll tell you, John, I listened to it, and first I didn't hear it. You know, I just didn't hear it.
Such a different tempo from the way you did it.
Yeah, but, what he did is he made it the Disappearing Railroad Blues, or at least that's what I ended up thinking he did with it. Everybody says, "Steve, how do you feel about Arlo's record getting played on the radio?" Well, it's a beautiful record. Very well-produced record, you know, and I always thought if we had made one that it was as good as that one. I'm talking about from a production standpoint and everything, it was just gorgeous. The sounds on the record, it was great, and he read the lyrics so well, you know. He slowed it down so everybody could hear the words.
What is it about City of New Orleans that makes it such a great universal song? Do you know?
No, man.
I mean, I realized that...
It was, John, that was an accident. I have no idea why that one... I mean, I don't think I'll ever write another one. You know, I mean, I like country songs and all that, but I like all kinds of music. I like, you know, swing and jazz and blues and all the stuff I grew up listening to as a kid. You know what I'm saying? So I have no idea why that one in particular is a train song or why it was a country song. I mean, I got lucky. If someone comes out of their house in the middle of the night and parts with cash to hear somebody play the guitar and sing, well, then you got to do something. You know, I mean, you have a responsibility not to just lay down. I've always felt that, though, about performing. For some reason, I feel a certain responsibility to both to the music and to the public. I think of myself first as an entertainer and then as either a singer or a songwriter or a guitarist. That's all secondary, I think, to a total concept.
Now, you mentioned the word entertainer, and I think that's really kind of a key to the way you approach what you're doing. You see yourself more than just a singer or a songwriter or a guitarist, right? I mean, it's an overall thing as an entertainer?
Oh, yeah, because I know I don't have Lead Belly's voice or Django Reinhardt's guitar chops or Prine or Dylan's ear for lyrics. You know, I'm not trying to be anything other than what I am. All my heroes have these great voices or great singers or great songwriters or this or that. And they're right, they were all great entertainers too. But I don't think I can just think of myself as emulating any one kind of thing. So once you get out on stage, there's a certain thing that happens between you and an audience that you try to create. And you do that with whatever songs will do that at the moment. I wouldn't write a set of songs down on the guitar for anything. You know, I would rather go up there and take a chance that something might happen between the audience and myself. I have a rough idea what I want to start with, and I have two or three I save for moments of disaster,
yeah.
You know, when nothing's happening, when that supposed grand interaction between the performer and the audience just isn't there on a given night, then there's two or three I can always bail out with, you know, that'll help me get out of the set. But that's just, you know, from experience that you can learn which ones to save and what have you. But mostly I like to see where people are at in a given evening, and I can pretty much tell.
You have an awful lot.
Steve Goodman talking with John Platt, then with WXRT back in April of 1975. This afternoon here on the program, we're talking about Steve Goodman. Our guest is Clay Eales, author of Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. What was Steve Goodman like to see in performance? I never had that pleasure. What was he like on stage?
Oh, my. He was, well, everybody who experienced him knows that the best Goodman was live Goodman, and as Steve Martin told me, I mean, he opened for Steve Martin more than 200 times, became the ultimate opening act for him. Steve Martin said he would get him in 30 seconds. He'd just come out there, you know, when the Red Red Robin comes bobbing along, this one little guy for playing for 15, 20,000 people. But he just had this energy and this ability to really to perform, as he said in the interview, to perform in the moment and not just come and do a pre-planned act. And I mean, he just got you. I was fortunate to see him a couple of times, and you know, I wooed my wife with his songs. I sent tapes of him. He ran the gamut of songs in his songwriting, and he could take you in a concert very up, high energy, bouncing on the balls of his feet, down to pin drop silence, just back and forth. It was a marvel to see. He ruined me for any other performer. I've never seen a performer as good as he was, and I don't think I ever will.
Yeah. Do you recall what your introduction was to the music of Steve Goodman?
Well, you know, I was a college student back in the early 70s, and I had his albums, like I had the albums of so many people, but what really riveted me first was seeing a show called Soundstage, which was in the November of 1974. It was recorded in Chicago and aired on Chicago's WTTW, but it was syndicated all over the country, and I was at my home in Eugene, Oregon, and my jaw just dropped watching this guy. It was a show with Goodman, Arlo Guthrie, and Hoyt Axton, and there's something mesmerizing about this guy that even came across on TV. And then I first got to see him live when I was still living in Eugene. I was a newspaper reporter there, and he was opening for Randy Newman. And Randy was touring on his only hit called Short People. And he had the ultimate short person opening for him. You know, Goodman was only 5'2". A guy isn't supposed to be 5'2", you know. And he made light of it. He would say, you know, I'm going to have to get stilts for this gig. And I mean, imagine a Randy Newman concert. I mean, he's a great songwriter and nothing to take away from him, but basically you're looking at a grand piano, and maybe you see half of Randy Newman's head in back of the piano, and he's looking down, and that's the visual effect of a Randy Newman concert. But Goodman is literally dancing up there, just a ball of energy.
Mm. You mentioned Steve Martin. You have interviewed so many people for this book. It is obviously a labor of love. It was. And there are so many stories included here between the covers of this book. You talked with Arlo Guthrie, Jimmy Buffett, Bonnie Raitt, Bonnie Kolak, Jackson Brown, Paul Anka, Pete Seeger. The list goes on and on. There are so many stories here. Do you have one or two that you'd like to share with us that you find something very special in a story or two that somebody told you along the way as you did these interviews?
Oh, there's so much to tell. I hope the book didn't break the mailbox off of your wall when you got it. It's all 4 pounds and 800 pages, and I did interview more than 1,000 people. It's hard to pick. Just things that come to mind. Many of your listeners may know the singer Phoebe Snow. She duetted with Goodman on one of his last albums on a song, and they got to know each other pretty well, played the same stage together, and literally she cried when talking to me about him. She found a very spiritual quality in him that really moved her, and that was not uncharacteristic. There are other people who this was a very emotional experience for them. The celebrities you're talking about are so used to talking about themselves and answering the same old questions, and given the opportunity to talk about Goodman, it's like imagine yourself, or I mean, we all have people like this who we knew, say, 20, 30 years ago and were close to, but somehow our paths have diverged and we're not in contact with them anymore. And then some guy like me comes up and says, hey, I'm doing a book on this person. Will you talk to me? And it's almost like a repressed emotion that pours out. Goodman had this effect on people. I guess another one I can bring up is somebody native to the state of Illinois, and that's this little-known rock star named Hillary Clinton, who went to high school with Goodman in Park Ridge. And I chased that interview for more than 6 years since Hillary was in the White House. But she remembers Goodman and those days in high school clear as a bell. And one thing that relates back to City of New Orleans is that she gave me an insight. That's a wonderful thing about interviewing people. You find out things you don't know. And she was saying that when the two of them were performing in a variety show in their junior year, this variety show was in the theme Showboat, and the most prominent song from that musical is Old Man River. And Goodman's part in this show was to sing this Old Man River song solo on stage. He was the first vocalist in the show. And usually this is sung by this tall, imposing, you know, African-American, basso profundo, Old Man River. And here's little Steve Goodman coming out in his trained temple voice singing it. And the recording of that survives, and I was able to describe that in the book. But what Hillary told me about that was that she thinks that the seeds of City of New Orleans were sown partly by his having to learn that song so well, because both songs follow the same course of the Mississippi River down to the Gulf of Mexico. Mm. And it's nice to have that insight in the book and also have it attributed to her. Both she and Bill have said in interviews over the year that Goodman is one of their favorite performers.
Mm. We've got a couple of people who'd like to talk with you, Clay.
Terrific.
So let's go to the phone lines. Our guest this afternoon, Clay Eales, he is the author of Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. This is The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. You can join us this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm kind of excited to maybe go out and get your book. I lived with Stevie my freshman year, probably his senior year at the U of I, the fall of 66 and spring of 67 over at Bromley Hall. He lived two doors from me in the hall, and Stevie wasn't much into school, that was for sure. he was a great guy. Won me a beer several years later in Colorado while skiing. Some lady performer was going to sing the City of New Orleans and ask if anybody knew the name of the individual that wrote it. And I was the only one in the room, of course, that knew about Stevie, and got to drink for free for the night. So I owe him that. But he was a wonderful person.
His time at Bromley Hall and the previous year in the Sammy House, one of the Jewish fraternities there, is a big part of Chapter 4. And you're right, he was a genius in so many ways. He had a phonographic memory, as somebody once said, and he was just, I mean, music was his life. But he didn't go to class, like you say. And he really went on academic probation after his first year at U of I, and for that reason he was not allowed back into the Sammy House, and he went to Bromley Hall, as you say. And okay. Then he dropped out in the spring of that year.
Well, he certainly, as you've described, just was had this energy, this life to him when it came to music and just in meeting and dealing with people. You know, he didn't throw it out there, well, I'm this musician that has this talent. If you happen to walk in his room, he was probably playing the guitar, but otherwise, you know, you wouldn't know that about him. He was very self-effacing, and I've forgotten, you know, how old it was when he passed away or what year that was, but...
He was 36, and it was in 1984.
Okay.
Well, he was diagnosed with leukemia when he was 20, and if you remember back to, this would have been 69, after the college years, leukemia at that time was a death sentence, and you were not expected to live but a few months or a year, and miraculously, through experimental treatment at Sloan Kettering in New York, he was able to stretch that out more than 15 years.
Well, he was quite a person, and I certainly remember him and hold him in high regard, and I'll look forward to checking out your book.
Well, please do, and at my website you can contact me directly, and I would love to talk with you a little bit, because, you know, the book, if it goes into a second printing, I might be able to get some insights from you into that second printing.
Sure. Okay, great. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Next we talk with a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana. Line 4, hi.
Hello. It's a great program. I was introduced to Steve Goodman through John Prine, and I wondered if you could talk a little. They seem to have a close relationship, a Prine with Goodman, and I wonder if you could talk a little about that.
Sure. John Prine is almost like a brother to Steve Goodman in the Goodman story, and so many people were introduced to either one because of knowing the other. They were managed by the same person. But what you got to realize about John Prine, and I was able to talk with him for 4 hours for the book. He was a huge source for this book, and he's all the way through it. But the thing to realize about him is that you probably wouldn't know about Prine if it weren't for Goodman. We talked earlier about Goodman's generosity. There's a lengthy story that I'll try to truncate here in the book about how Goodman was discovered by Christofferson and Paul Anka, this unlikely duo. And at the very moment that Goodman impressed Paul Anka to the point where Paul Anka says, would you like a plane ticket to New York? In other words, would you like the opportunity to come and record demos and maybe get a record contract? Probably 99% of the people in the world would say, well, gee, thank you, Mr. Anka. This is a wonderful opportunity. I, of course, the answer is yes. But that wasn't the first thing that Goodman said. First thing he said in response to would you like a plane ticket to New York was, well, if you think I'm good, you got to hear my friend John Prine. And the next night, this little entourage of Christofferson and Anka and a few other people go to hear Prine, and immediately Paul Anka is buying two plane tickets to New York. to me, that's the that's almost the, that's the quintessential story of the book, where Goodman, and part of understanding that story is that Prine went on to much greater, in any measure of success that you might use, he was more successful than Goodman. He sold more records. He was always the star on the bill, and Goodman was the opening act. So there is that irony there that Goodman propelled his friend to greater heights than he might have achieved himself.
Mm-hmm.
Their friendship endured throughout their lives, and Prine is still quite emotional in talking about Goodman today. And if you ever go to a Prine concert, he always dedicates the song that he wrote called Souvenirs to Goodman. The two of them recorded a memorable duet of that song, and Prine holds Goodman in his heart to this day.
I want to thank the listener for his question. Let's go and take another call. A listener in Belgium, Illinois, line 2. Hi.
Good afternoon. I was wondering if you could slightly elaborate on something you spoke of just a little earlier, and that was, you said you saw some sort of special with Goodman and Hoyt Axton and Arlo Guthrie.
Yes.
Is it all available today?
It's not available for you to purchase. Occasionally, in some retrospective on WTTW, you would be able to see some of that footage. I'm not even sure that WTTW itself has the full footage of that show, but it's available. I was able to get it from a firm in New York called Historic Films, and you can look them up on the web for a fee. But that show was really a wonderful show. It was a one-hour show. It was called Arlo's Gang, and it, as I said, it aired in November of 74. But the thing that you can do readily anytime you want on the web, as we've been talking about, the best Goodman was live Goodman, and his records never really did him justice. And so to be able to experience him now that he's gone, the best way to do so is to see him as well as hear him. And 4 years ago, there was an official DVD released, and it was not this soundstage show, but it was a combination of Steve Goodman's two appearances on Austin City Limits. And then there are a few other filler tracks in there of Dying Cub Fan and You're the Girl I Love and some interview footage. But the bulk of this is his two appearances on Austin City Limits, and this is a stellar product. People ask me if there's one thing... If to introduce myself to Steve Goodman, if there's one product I can get to experience him, that's the one I recommend all the time. It's called Live from Austin City Limits and More. I mean, it really, he never really did give a bad show, but these shows are stellar, and you really understand it.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Sure.
You're very welcome. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Clay Eales, author of the new book, Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. You'll find our guest on the web at www.clayeales.com. That's CLAYEALS.com. There's a story in the book. We probably need to talk about the diagnosis of leukemia, when and how he learned about that he had leukemia. And he had, as any of us would, I think, especially at the outset, he had a tough time with it, but eventually he came right around. And, you know, he lived with that diagnosis. He lived with the possibility that he could go almost at any time for a number of years. Tell us about how he lived with leukemia.
He was a great proponent of gallows humor. So, I mean, laughing at death was a huge tool of his in dealing with it. Of course, as you say, anybody would be angry about this, sort of the why me thing. And then he said in one interview, he finally got to the point of, well, why not me? the probably one of the better known songs of Goodman that deals with the topic of death is called The Dying Cub Fan's Last Request, which he insisted was not autobiographical, but I think that was a dodge. It was clearly about him. where he's telling people, his friends gathered around his deathbed, you know, I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels play, but you hear the living, you're stuck with the Cubs, so it's me who feels sorry for you. I mean, this is emblematic of his approach. He tried to keep it a secret because he didn't want to be known as the sick guy in performing his craft. He wanted to be known for his musicianship, and it wasn't until a couple of years before he died when it was unavoidably released, when he missed a concert in New York City and his leukemia relapsed, that it became public. And so there were many interviews during 1983 and early 84 in which he addressed the topic. And again, with the self-deprecation and humor, he would say, you know, you have as much chance of this as I do. You know, he at one point, I mean, one of his responses was, you know, it was one out of four people have an oncological situation of some sort in their life. So if you're in a room with three other people and they're healthy, maybe you better go to the doctor. I mean, this was his way of coping. And if you look at his songs, fully half or more of his songs have explicit or implicit references to mortality. It's all through his songs, whether they're romantic or social comment songs or funny songs. And really, mortality really is the thread of my book. It's how do you live mm-hmm. with what time we have left here? You know, what are we going to do with our lives? And I think too often we take life for granted, and Steve Goodman could never do that. He had death on his shoulder every day of his adult life, and I think you live differently that way, and there's some lessons to be drawn from how to live. It's just all over his life and in his music.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Bloomington, Illinois, line 4.
Hi. Thanks so much for having this interview today.
You're very welcome.
My question is about this distinction between the live and recorded music in Steve Goodman's work.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's just that the earlier recorded albums are quite excellent, and it seemed to me that it was after 1980 that the bad production kicked in, and I was wondering if you would comment on that.
Well, I don't know about good or bad production, but the word that might be used is overproduction. You got to understand the times. I mean, biography is all about context, and you know, folk music and singer-songwriters were somewhat the rage in the early 70s, but as the decade progressed, in came disco and then punk and new wave, and the folk-based people were on the outs. And it was in 1981 that Goodman was dropped from Asylum Records, which he had made 5 albums for. And what really happened throughout the 70s, so many, and yes, I agree with you that the albums are excellent, but the rap on them, which I think is pretty accurate, is that you didn't get enough Steve. He was sort of sublimated to the overproduction, whether it was other instruments, whether it was strings. And he, as he kept straining for some sort of success as the decade proceeded, his albums became more and more produced, and his albums sold less and less and less to the point where he was dropped. And you know, the Steve himself was his own worst enemy in this regard, because he would explain that you can't see a record. That he said that you can't just put a person live on a record the way you would see him in a concert, because you lose that visual sense, and so you have to fill something in to create more color, to create more of a picture in your ears as you're listening to a song. And he succeeded in so many ways. His one of his phrases for himself was that he was the hectic eclectic, and it made his albums hard to, I mean, if you remember the record album bins back in the 70s, you know, there would be rock, folk, country, blues, but where would you put Goodman? He fit in all of those. Some of his songs were in all of those categories, and so the when he lost his record contract and after his leukemia relapsed, he couldn't go on the road. He was recovering. And they assembled some live tracks and for the album that was called Artistic Hair, and Goodman was really a pioneer in starting his own label. People do that today all the time. They sell their CDs. It's an accepted and a wonderful practice, but back then it was unseemly. You know, you were either on a contract with a record label or you were nothing. And he was a pioneer in starting his own label. And really, the live tracks on those albums had more energy, more Steve in them than the more heavily produced albums that he did in the studio. Both are good, though. I think you can find good stuff on both of them.
Okay. Well, thanks for that answer.
Sure.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. There's a story in the book that I'd like you to tell kind of quickly, and then I want to wrap up with a tune from the companion CD to the book, Richer for the Time. The story I want you to tell involves Rich Warren, our Rich Warren, we like to think of him as, host of the Midnight Special for a long time now.
Mm-hmm.
And he, tell us the story the first time Rich met Steve Goodman, was the Earl of Old Town, right?
Well, yeah, and Rich, you know, Rich was a protege of Ray Nordstrand, and Ray was the longtime host of the Midnight Special along with Norm Pellegrini. And Bonnie Kolak, who was a prominent singer in the Chicago scene at the same time, had gone back to visit Goodman at Sloan Kettering in New York, and had come back with this song, this first song, serious song that Steve had written called Song for David, which was really a song about his leukemia. Very sad, metaphorical song. And she performed it on the Midnight Special, and the word was at the time that this was from a guy who was dying, and we wanted to get his song on the air. Well, Rich was well aware of this, hanging around with Ray Nordstrand at that time, and even broadcasted on his own Champaign-Urbana show at the same time. Well, then he is at the Earl of Old Town, and he sees this singer performing, and the singer starts singing Song for David and other songs, and Rich Warren is astonished and says to himself, well, how does this guy know? And he goes up to the performer and says, gee, you know Steve Goodman's songs. And the guy says, well, I'm Steve Goodman, and I'm not dead yet. And he asked Goodman permission to record him, and a couple of weeks later he did so at the Earl of Old Town. Those are among the earliest of the probably 200 concert tapes that I've compiled as research material for the book, and it's 2.5 hours of very early Goodman, not much songwriting by him, a lot of covers of other people's songs, Tom Paxton and others, and it's very revealing of the performer that he was and was to become. Yeah, Rich was integral in the whole thing, and it is kind of a fun story to tell, a very life-affirming story to tell.
Yeah. Well, now we've got to wrap it up. We're out of time, I'm sorry to say. Maybe we could have you back on the show. You could tell more stories.
I would love to, anytime.
Okay. So let's go out here with a lovely tune, Richer for the Time. The artist is Norm Hacking. You want to say anything about it?
Well, this is a story song, but it's a very universal one, and the song really tells its own story. It's a lovely song. It's very specific about Goodman, but it applies to anybody who has an appreciation for music.
Okay, here we go.
I hear a smile in a song and I turn around. That's the way that it's always been. A sweet, warm voice will come along and steal your heart. You'll gladly sail with that song on the wind. Feeling richer for the time we all sing together. Staying up late till the bitter end. And whatever is lost in the winter frost is on in our hearts like the song of a friend. I paid for both shows one night at the riverboat so I could watch Steve Goodman play. I moved up close when the crowd changed for the second show. I learned the chords to the Dutchman that way. And there ain't no way I'm gonna say too much. to guide you. We only spoke just a time or two, but I'll be spending my days writing songs on this old guitar. Much of that is because of you. Feeling richer for the time we all sing together. Stayed up late till the bitter end, and whatever is lost in the winter frost. It's all in our hearts like the song of the free.
Richer for the time. That comes from the companion CD to Clay Eales's book, Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. The artist there, Richer for the Time, Norm Hacking, he's a Canadian. Our guest this afternoon was Clay Eales, the author of the biography of Steve Goodman, Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. The publisher is ECW Press. And our guests can be found on the website www.clayeales.com.